Good morning, and thank you very, very much for that incredibly generous and complete introduction. I'm somewhat saddened my mother was not here for it, but she would have finally been proud of me. And it is a tremendous honor to be here. It is an incredible conference and an incredible group of individuals that I think have come together across two countries for what we have is a very shared purpose around education and medical education, and a deep pride as family doctors committed to education, certainly for the next generation of doctors, but also for the current generation of doctors in practice and for our patients. Normally when I give a talk like this, I like to start with something sort of upbeat and positive. You seem hopeful that I'll do that. And after that very generous sort of introduction of my history, I'm sort of almost embarrassed to open my session with something very different. I want to talk to you, in fact, and I want to talk to you, quite frankly, about three failures that I've had as a family doctor. Normally, I'd like to stand up and tell you, you know, here's a great paper, here's a great awesomeness, here's something fantastic we've done here in Ontario or here in Canada or at my clinic. But actually, I want to talk to you quite honestly today. Please don't tweet any of this out. I saw my chairman here earlier today. I'm hoping he's not here because I'm going up for academic promotion, so not ideal. But I want to talk to you about three failures. So here's the first one. So this is my practice data, and it is my colorectal screening, and there are three lines on there. The green one is mine. The yellow one is my local clinical practice, and the other one is actually about our entire clinical practice across all of our sites. And as we know, as good family doctors, colorectal screening is important. It's how we save lives. It's one of the few things that really preventative medicine works. It's one of the few things where we have regular touch with our patients and we can engage them with. And frankly, I am at best average with my peers across the practice. And frankly, I didn't go in to be average, nice like you guys. You all think you do better. In fact, as soon as you saw that, you thought, my goodness, my data is way better than his. And frankly, as a practice, this is not fantastic. This is not great performance. We're at sort of the 70-ish percentile for something that is not new. I mean, no, we're not just starting to do colorectal screening in the last 3 years. This is not something we're just turning our mind to. And the worst part is, when I get this data, I can't even tell you which patients I'm missing. I couldn't even, now very quickly, I immediately identified the flaws in the data and said, well, there's, you know, two patients here that, you know, are deceased and I haven't registered. And, you know, there's my Muslim patient who's been forbidden from doing it and whatever. But that is not going to close the gap. And I don't even know entirely who that gap is. So that's my first failing. My second failing has actually been a failing for about 3 to 4 years. And I didn't even know I was failing. So 3 to 4 years ago, probably close to 4 years ago, a new person came and joined my practice. Like many of my patients, he's fragilely housed. He has a very disrupted life. He's on disability for mental health issues. I introduced him to our practice. I brought him in. I noticed he was on a benzodiazepine. I quickly shamed him and explained how terrible benzodiazepines are. Over the first 4 or 5 months of his practice, I had him sign a benzodiazepine contract with me immediately, put him through urine drug screening immediately, and made him commit that if he wanted to be my patient, we would work collaboratively in a patient-centered way to get off these terrible drugs. And I quoted him all the evidence and handed him, you know, some good handouts on the evils of benzodiazepines. He was on temazepam, 7.5 milligrams QHS, and had been for years. And over 6 to 9 months of our new relationship, I carefully weaned him off of his benzodiazepine declared success and moved on in our relationship. A hero in the anti-benzodiazepine campaign. Self-proclaimed. About 6 weeks ago, he came in, and I've seen him periodically throughout this time, filled out his disability renewal forms, a special diets form, his travel allowance, things like that. He's young, he's not ready for colorectal screening, so I'm not failing on that one. I'm not blending my failures for you. Each one is unique and joyful in itself. And he came in, and he was agitated. And he said, I spent about 8 months writing this letter for you. I said, okay, tell me what you got. And he said, ever since you took me off that benzodiazepine when I first met you several years ago, my life has completely fallen apart. And I haven't known how to tell you this. And so this is a bit of the opening. Since stopping sleep medication has become necessary to put everything on pause due to various instabilities. This includes getting dental and optical work done, seeking a mental health professional, returning to work, maintaining personal hygiene, relationships, and a host of other issues. A little about me. And then he went on for about 2.5 to 3.5 pages to tell me about who he was, the trauma he'd endured, physical, emotional, and sexual growing up, about the embarrassment and stigmatization that he'd suffered, about what had led him to this point where those sleeping pills were the only thing that brought normalcy to his life. Four years of our relationship, years after I had become a benzodiazepine hero for taking away his 7.5 milligrams QHS. And I get this letter. This is a tree behind my clinic. Actually, it's not the clinic I work in anymore. It's the clinic I worked at for about 5 years, between about 2007 to 2011, 2012. It's very close to here. You could walk here and see this tree on your lunch break. You just head out, head to Bay Street, walk up about 8 blocks, turn right 1 block just before Bloor. You'll see a small, small church that's been converted into a community housing site. And in behind is a small fenced backyard with this tree. One of my young Indigenous patients a few years ago hung himself on this tree behind my clinic. He actually didn't die that day. He was rescued by his friends, but he died about 1.5 years ago from opioid overdose on the streets of Toronto. These are three failings that haunt me every day. Every day, I think about these patients. I cycle a lot, or I used to cycle a lot before I had my current job. And I cycle past this tree. Every time I go and I see patients, I see my little reminders about my poor bright red colorectal screening rates. Every time I see this patient now, and I saw him actually on Monday, which I guess was yesterday, I think about the letter he had to write me that took him 8 months because of his education level, because of how hard it was to have this conversation, to tell me who he was and how my actions had impacted him for years. So historically, as a family doctor, if I wanted to get better, and I went back to my residency training, and I'm not that old, I'd like to think, and I thought back, what would I have in my residency training and what's subsequent to my residency training to help me improve in my failures? And I would have had three things: teaching, research, and clinical care. And I'm an academic family doctor, like most of you, in fact, all of you. And so I take great pride in these three pillars of our stool, the classic triad of a good academic medicine. And I wonder, how will these three circles help me with those patients and with those failures? And I would actually argue they don't help a heck of a lot. There's no RCT or cohort study that's really going to help me improve those patients. coming to my conference like this and going to a session isn't going to suddenly educate me about the latest clinical guidelines and help me suddenly close the gap on my colorectal screening. And I can work hard on clinical care, but actually I work pretty hard already. So I can work harder at clinical care, but frankly, I, like you, work pretty damn hard. So everything I was given as a trainee and as a practicing physician is not going to help me with these failures. And it's not even a word I like to say. The opportunities for improvement, my growth opportunities. But we're starting to have a discourse about something that can, and that's quality improvement. I was worried it was very early in the morning and you wouldn't notice the subtle addition of a new circle into the diagram, so I color-coded it. It's orange. To which my daughter would say, it's pink, because everything is pink or purple. And I actually would say that for the greatest challenges we have right now, for us as frontline family doctors, for the vast majority of frontline family doctors, the tens of thousands of us across North America, actually, it's quality improvement that is going to help us move forward. There is a small overlap with research, because some research is quality improvement, and some quality improvement will ultimately make it into research. We are saying, you know, it's very hard to get academic promotion on it because New England Journal rarely publishes your QI. But there is BMJ quality and patient safety. There is periodically great QI initiatives on NISQIP and JAMA or whatever, National Surgical Quality Improvement Plan. Every now and then there is quality improvement that crosses that threshold into real capital R research. But most of it doesn't, but there's an overlap. Some teaching crosses over into QI, and there are great teachers in QI. But most QI is not pedagogically driven, and most of what we teach every day is not QI. Most of what we teach every day is about other aspects, guidelines, clinical care, patient-centered listening, all sorts of other things than the actual tactics of QI. Most of us don't spend days with our residents teaching run charge, PDSA cycles, tests of change. We teach them, you know, other things related to their clinical practice. But there is an overlap. And of course, most of our clinical care is just providing clinical care and seeing that slate of patients that's before us. But hopefully a small part of our clinical care is going to increasingly be focused on QI. So QI has to be added to our armament, but it should not be confused as synonymous with the others because it is only an element. And too often people say, oh yeah, you know, I'm involved in research, I'm a QI expert. I'm like, no. Or, oh yeah, I'm involved in teaching, so, you know, as a teacher, obviously I'm a QI expert. No. You might be fantastic at teaching clinical exams or social determinants of health or, you know, whatever else you're an expert at teaching, patient-centered listening, interview skills, interprofessional team stuff, but that doesn't make you an expert in teaching QI. And in fact, for the vast majority of family doctors, the tens of thousands of us across North America, we don't expect them to become New England Journal researchers. We don't expect them to become pedagogical experts. Not all 10,000 and thousands of family doctors are teachers. You are, but not the vast majority. But all of us should be providing clinical care, and all of us should be doing quality improvement. So the question is, how do we start to do this? What is the path to doing this? It's three steps. It's information, it's knowledge, and it's improvement. It's relatively easy, actually, to think about building a culture. So what does it mean to have to do information, knowledge, and improvement? Well, what do we mean by information? We mean data and narrative. And for too long, I have heard family doctors, particularly in smaller settings, say, you know what, we're not a hospital, we don't have data. right? I don't have, you know, my discharge database. I don't have a business analytics support. I don't have a decision analysis support. I don't have, you know, 15 statisticians like a hospital. And I'm a hospital CEO now. I know how good I have it when it comes to data. I don't have Meditech and Cerner and Epic. You know, I'm just a family doctor and a three-person family practice out here operating in a clinic. But actually, we all have data. We all have data. In fact, there's very few of us left who are paper-based. And even if you are still paper-based, and I won't ask you to raise your hands and identify yourselves, you still have data. And beyond data, you have stories. Because those stories drive your QI as much as the spreadsheets drive QI. And so actually, we all have data. And is it perfect? No. But you're not trying to get a randomized control trial out there. You're not trying to get carefully designed cohort study out there. You're trying to improve what you do every day in a small area. And you're trying to understand where you need to start that conversation. And maybe it's a letter from a patient. Maybe it's data that you get, whether you want it or not. Like, I got my colorectal screening. Oh, thank you. Here's a gift. Unasked for, from my cancer society, saying, here's your colorectal data, and my cervical, and my breast mammography. And it arrives. The next thing is knowledge. Quality improvement is its own knowledge. And about 20 years ago, we started deciding that everybody should graduate knowing what a p-value is and why an anecdote is not the same as a randomized clinical trial. And we just decided that nobody's going to graduate without knowing what a p-value is. Now, you guys are all researchers, and I've read all the arguments about why the p-value is an evil and a scourge. Nonetheless, we train people to understand what sensitivity and specificity is. But what we haven't until very recently done is train people to know what a PDSA or a run chart or the five whys or the nine whys or I don't know, there's an endless number of whys. Especially if, how many of you have like a three-year-old? They are the master at the QI why. But why? But why? I'm like, oh, you're like a green belt or something. But I never feel improved by our conversations. Just deeply frustrated. And then, of course, So we made an investment, and I was heartened to learn that every resident, family medicine resident in North America, or at least in the United States, and when you talk to Americans, they're like, North America, Canada, U.S., it's just, you know, it's one. Like, no, there's still a border. Surprise. At least in the United States, everybody has to do QI now, and that is a tremendous generational change. But even for those of us who are out in practice, we have to figure out these skills. And so we come to conferences like this and we learn the latest in breaking bad news and we learn the latest in how to help the failing resident and we learn the latest in bedside ultrasound and we learn the latest in, you know, or we do a refresher on ECG. But how many of us go to a conference like this and take a one-day refresher on PDSA? We go and we do our ACLS or our BCLS because we have to or we want to. But how many of us go to a conference like this and say, what, you know, how do I do that run charter? How do I put that data into a run charter? What is a fishbone diagram? You know, I did it a couple years ago, but you know, like all knowledge, it sort of seeps to the back of my brain and then farther and farther away. You know, how many of us go as part of our CPD and commit to developing the skills? We go and find out what's the latest, you know, are we really using 2 grams of ceftriaxone for, you know, otitis media? Oh, no, we're not. Okay, well, that was a good session. But how many of us are going, don't do that. No ceftriaxone for, because some people are like, oh, really? No, you know. But what are you doing around QI? And finally, nothing happens. This all sits there unless you have leadership. And so my guess is you guys are all clinical expert leaders. You're teachers. You are experts in education. That's what this conference is about. And I'll bet you if I turn to you, most of you know who your educational leaders are in your organization. And I'll bet you most of you actually know who will be the next education leader. And you're grooming them. They're the deputy clinical clerkship whatever person. They are sitting on some deanery committee. They are going off and getting masters of education with the support of your leadership. And so you know who your current leadership in medical education is, and you know where the next generation of medical education leadership is coming from, and you're investing medical education leadership through masters and academic promotion. How many of you could really say, who are the QI experts in your practice? Where's the next tranche of QI going to come from? How much are we doing to support the QI leaders in the way that we support researchers? There's early career grants for researchers. There's mid-career grants for researchers. There's whole programs to go and fund people to go off and become good researchers. When I went off and I wanted to become a better researcher, which I did at one point in my career, they found me money. They sent me off to Harvard. They gave me quantitative skills, brought me home, set me up with a whole mentorship group, and tried to make me a researcher. It was horrible. I failed. It's a different story. I won't bore you with it now. Still scarred. But the point is, we don't do that for quality improvement in the same way, in the same structured way. So where's the leadership? And of course, finally, there's failure. And this is a very uncomfortable discussion for us to have in healthcare, because as doctors, we're perfect. You know? That's what we say, that's what we talk about, and a whole concept of quality improvement is actually starting with a fundamental tenet that actually there's a gap between where we are and where we should be. And until we can have these fundamental conversations about the failings of our system and of our own practices and of our clinics and ourselves, we're really going to struggle to have a meaningful conversation of quality improvement. We're very quick to identify our colleagues' gaps in opportunity for improvement, but our own, we have a hard conversation. But this is the fundamental cornerstone of quality improvement, is acknowledging where we are and where we start and where we need to be better. So very quickly, we need to know where we're going. We need a goal for quality improvement. You can make many goals, but ultimately, I like this goal. It's the quadruple aim. And many of us have heard about the triple aim. I actually think the quadruple aim is what we need to talk about. It's about improving things for our population as a whole. It's about improving things for individual patients. It's about driving efficiency in the system. And it's about providing a better provider experience. And as we finally start to have a frank, open conversation about the pandemic of burnout among our profession, the pandemic of suicide, if not quite a pandemic, startling statistics around suicide, startling statistics around alcohol use disorder, startling statistics about other substance use disorder among our profession, we need to think about provider well-being. And what I worry a lot about is that QI is often done in a shaming way. QI is often done in a blaming way. QI is often talked about as failings, but not in the constructive failings, but where we have gotten it wrong. And who wants to be part of a QI initiative that has that premise? So what I like about the quadruple aim is it acknowledges absolutely the purpose of quality improvement is to improve frontline care. But it also has to be an exercise that lifts us up as providers, that reaches into our sense of purpose, that equips us with a sense of mastery, so that QI is part of what we do. Here in Canada, we have four principles of family medicine, and they're the first four. We're a skilled clinician, we're a community-based discipline, we're a resource to a defined practice, and the patient-physician relationship is central to the role of the family physician. Now, the fact that I had to turn to read it tells you how far away from my exams I am, because that's on every exam you have to take, and I used to have it like stone cold. You'd wake up in the middle of the night and you could quote the four pillars when you were near your exam. My argument has been that we need to add a fifth pillar to family medicine. And that pillar is that the family physician embraces a culture, a skill set, and a practice of quality improvement. Because it is the essence of what we need to do. It is the essence of what we need to do to close the gap between where we are and where we want to be. These are all very, very different problems. These are fundamentally different gaps in our system. And it's tempting to say that, at best, quality improvement can help us on the middle one. It's tempting to say that if there's one spot for QI to rest and for us to think about, it's on colorectal screening. And I get that. I understand that view. It's data-driven. You can bring the team around you. You can get your list of patients. But I would argue that the other two gaps in our system, the other two failings we have, are equally important to lend our skills of QI. And I'll just spend a minute to talk and to close on my patient who ultimately died of an overdose and who hung himself on that tree behind my clinic. He was a survivor of the terrible tragedy in our country, of the residential school system in which Indigenous youth were taken from their families, abused, typically sexually, physically, and emotionally, and ripped from their cultures. He grew up and left an environment of tremendous transition. He had intergenerational trauma. He turned to substance use disorder to manage this. He had deep PTSD. It is a failing not just me as a clinician, or my clinic, or of our province, but of a fundamental part of our system that we had for decades. And we see this replicated in other marginalized populations, be it Indigenous, or LGBTQ, or other racialized groups. And I would just say these are big problems, but they are not outside the reach of a group as powerful and as knowledgeable and as passionate as this, and they are not outside the reach of the skill sets and the ethos of good quality improvement. A culture of quality improvement will reach from the very front lines to the individual relationship we have and sometimes miss up to our clinical practice, to broad system issues. Thank you for taking a few minutes to move from a conversation on education to a conversation on QI, because the opportunities for our patients know no bounds. Thank you very much.